From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Kimberly Atkins, Chief Washington Reporter at the Boston Herald, and this is On Point. In the news this week, the Trump administration said it's slapping steel and aluminum tariffs on its closest allies after all. Here's Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau.
Let me be clear. These tariffs are totally unacceptable.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo met with his North Korean counterpart Kim Jong-chol in an effort to restore the high-stakes summit.
One not ought to be either surprised or frightened or deterred by moments where it looks like there are challenges and difficulties, things that can't be bridged. Our mission is to bridge them so that we can achieve this historic outcome.
And ABC canceled Roseanne this week after Roseanne Barr tweeted a racist comment about former Obama advisor Valerie Jarrett. Jarrett called it a teaching moment.
I'm fine. I'm worried about all the people out there who don't have a circle of friends and followers who come right to their defense. The person who's walking down the street minding their own business and they see somebody cling to their purse or want to cross the street. Or every black parent I know who has a boy who has to sit down and have a conversation, the talk, as we call it.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Anita Kumar, Philip Rucker, and Jack Beattie. You can join us on air or online. Will the new tariffs protect American jobs, or will Americans end up paying higher prices on imported goods? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining us now from Washington is Philip Rucker, White House Bureau Chief for The Washington Post. Phil, great to have you with us.
Hi, Kim. Good to be here.
Also with us from Washington is Anita Kumar, White House correspondent for McClatchy. Anita, welcome to On Point.
Great. Thanks for having me.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point news analyst Jack Beattie joins us. Hi, Jack.
Hello, Kim, Philip, and Anita.
So let's get started by talking about these new tariffs that the president is planning on levying on Canada, Mexico, and the EU, just on the heels of news that he is going to put tariffs on some imports from China as well. What does that mean for U.S. relations with some of our closest allies, Phil?
Well, it's troubling for the relationship with our close allies. It actually comes a few days before President Trump is set to fly to Canada. He's going to be attending the Group of Seven summit. That's the summit of the seven largest Western economies up near Quebec. And that could be a very contentious meeting. I mean, Trump has antagonized many European countries. He's now antagonized Canada and Mexico with these trade tariffs. It's something he believes very strongly about. He campaigned on this. It's not really a surprise that he's pursuing it. But nonetheless, it really changes the world order and the relationship with some of these allies.
And it's not a surprise that the president is tweeting about this today. He tweeted, Canada has treated our agricultural businesses and farmers very poorly for a very long period of time, highly restrictive on trade, exclamation point. They must open their markets and take down their trade barriers, exclamation point. They report a really high surplus on trade with us, do timber and lumber in U.S. Anita, what do you think about all of this?
Right. I mean, you're hearing conflicting information, right? You're hearing a lot of people, economists in the United States, saying that it's going to lead to higher prices for products here in the United States. But yes, I think it is part of the, you know, bigger issue with President Trump. It's not a surprise, and yet it is a surprise, right? He campaigned on it. He's talked about it. We've known about this for some months now. So it's not a surprise in that regard. But that a lot of the people you mentioned, the Prime Minister of Canada, the European allies, they thought they were, you know, they had been exempt a little bit, right? They had had a reprieve, and they thought they were continue to get that one. So they were surprised at what happened. Also surprised were members of Congress, members of his own party who had been, including the Speaker, who had been lobbying him hard and thought they were getting through to him that certain countries should be off the table.
Yesterday, French Finance Minister Bruno Le Maire spoke with NPR about these new tariffs.
The EU countries will never accept to negotiate under pressure. We are ready to work with the United States on many issues, including the renewal of the WTO. We are fully aware that the trade system that the WTO needs to be improved, but we cannot negotiate. We cannot enter into any kind of discussion under the pressure and being hit by tariffs will not help us to open the door to any kind of negotiation.
Jack, could this backfire on President Trump?
It could certainly backfire on Americans, on America's workers. Recently, Senator Lamar Alexander, Republican, had a colloquy with the president, and he told him, he said, quote, "Mr. President, we found there were," he's talking about Bush, George Bush tariffs early in his administration. They ran on steel, they ran for 18 months. And he said, "We found that there were 10 times as many people in steel using industries as there were in steel producing industries." Mm. They lost more jobs than existed in the steel industry. And I checked the figures. That's in fact correct. 3,500 jobs in steel were added and 200,000 jobs elsewhere in the economy were lost because of those tariffs. That's not some theory. That's experience. That's what happened. And the president looked to Alexander, according to the reporting, and said, well, that happened under Bush. It's not going to happen under me.
All right. And meanwhile, the news this morning on the jobs front is good, with the unemployment rate matching its lowest point in half a century. It makes you wonder why the president isn't talking a little bit more about that. We have John calling from Dothan, Alabama. Hi, John.
Hi, Kim. What my comment is that in the United States, we have an employment-based tax system where 80% of the taxes collected comes from employment jobs in the United States. And at the same time, we have a consumption-based economy where 70% of the economy is based on consumption. So unless we have a value-added tax, like most of these countries, like Germany has a 19% import tax, so to speak, then until we get to the point where we have a consumption-based tax system, then you have to have tariffs or something to level the playing field and to decrease these trade deficits. And I think that that may be the issue that if Trump would explain it like that, he has a working understanding of it, but if he would explain it like that, then I think you'd have more people that would understand that we're losing our tax base as we outsource or we improve technology and all these other areas, because we don't collect taxes good on goods made overseas.
Yeah, John, thanks for that call. Phil, what do you think about that? Is that the point that the White House is making, trying to boost this employment-based tax system?
Partially. I mean, I think the overall point that the White House is trying to make is to change these trade deficits and you know, create stimulate the economy in more ways here domestically. It's something President Trump has campaigned on and made a centerpiece of all of these trade and economic initiatives, including the tax package that passed at the end of last year.
All right. I want to move on to the pardons that the president has either granted or said he's thinking about. First, Dinesh D'Souza, the conservative commentator, received a pardon, and Trump floated pardons for Martha Stewart and Rod Blagojevich, both who happen to be Celebrity Apprentice alums in one way or another. Anita, what signal was the president trying to send?
I saw that myself. He's granted five pardons right now, and it appears that he's going through a very different process, even though he's gotten thousands of requests. You know, normally it's a long process, but he's, and staff looks at it before it even gets to his desk. It sounds like, you know, like many things he does, he's reading things or hearing things. In the case of the pardon yesterday, it sounds like Senator Ted Cruz of Texas brought it to his attention, and he's making a decision. I mean, it's his prerogative to do that, but it's once again another time where people are saying he should be thinking things through. Of course, the people you're talking about are one time or another supporters. I don't think Martha Stewart's much of a supporter anymore, but you know, people he's known from TV or from his celebrity life. So
right.
It's interesting how he's making these decisions.
D'Souza talked with the folks on Fox and Friends this morning about the phone call he received from the president with news of that pardon.
The president said, Dinesh, you've been a great voice for freedom. And he said that, I got to tell you, man to man, you've been screwed. He goes, I've been looking at the case. I knew from the beginning that it was fishy. But he said upon reviewing it, he felt a great injustice had been done and that using his power, he was going to rectify it, sort of clear the slate. And he said he just wanted me to be out there to be a bigger voice than ever defending the principles that I believe in.
Jack, the offenses that are being pardoned or that Trump is thinking of pardoning, campaign finance violations, obstruction of justice, that those sound like similar things that some of his allies could be currently facing. Is that what's going on here?
I think that is. I mean, he's sending a signal that can't be missed to, you know, the group of people who may be able to be under pressure to turn on him. And he's signaling you can get a pardon. He's using the pardon power. You know, it looks on the surface to obstruct justice in advance, and or to taint it in any case. And it's a sorry moment when you consider how Anita mentions how careful this has been done. Carefully, this has been done in the past. President Obama, for example, pardoned I think something 1,000 people, but it was all about the sentences. They were over sentenced for drug use and so on, and there was a very careful process of, you know, looking at the case, looking at this. With the president, it seems to be all about signaling on the one hand and this sort of celebrity friendliness on the other.
And right, and the point that you're making, I mean, neither Martha Stewart nor Dinesh D'Souza was in jail when these were happening.
Right.
It wasn't like they really needed these. We're talking about the week's top stories. You can join the conversation. Can talks with North Korea be salvaged? Will President Trump fire Attorney General Jeff Sessions now that he claims he shouldn't have been hired in the first place? I'm Kimberly Atkins. This is On Point.
How much would you pay to avoid morning traffic? Why are plane tickets to Boise so expensive? I'm Cardiff Garcia, co-host of The Indicator. In every episode, we take on a new, unexpected idea to help you make sense of the day's news. Listen every afternoon on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins. We're talking about the week in the news. You can join the conversation. If Roseanne lost her show, should Samantha Bee be the next for making a derogatory remark about Ivanka Trump? Should more American businesses conduct implicit bias training like Starbucks did this week? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guests today are Philip Rucker of The Washington Post, Anita Kumar of McClatchy, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Let's turn to North Korea. Today, Mike Pompeo will be meeting with Kim Jong-chol in New York. Yesterday, before flying to Houston, President Trump spoke to reporters at Joint Base Andrews about the preliminary talks with North Korea and that plan to move forward with the summit in Singapore.
It's a process. It's all a process. We'll see. And hopefully we'll have a meeting on the 12th that's going along very well. But I want it to be meaningful. It doesn't mean it gets all done at one meeting. Maybe you have to have a second or a third, and maybe we'll have none. But it's in good hands.
The president essentially is saying, as he likes to, we'll see what happens, Phil. What are the stakes here?
They're very high. And the White House, it's worth pointing out, is proceeding as if this summit is in fact going to take place on June 12th. There's an advance team led by the deputy chief of staff at the White House, Joe Hagan, that's in Singapore right now going over the logistical preparations, the stagecraft, the pageantry of the summit. There's a separate team on the Korean Peninsula right now trying to work through the substance of the summit. What exactly will the leaders be talking about? What kind of deliverable or outcome could there be from this deal? And thirdly, you have the North Korean delegation heading down to the White House today. We'll see if he has a meeting with President Trump. I suspect that may happen. And he's said to be delivering a letter from Kim Jong-un to Donald Trump. I don't know what that letter will say, but it very well could officially accept this summit and set it off and make it official and set that in motion.
All right. John is calling from Canton, Ohio. Hi there, John.
Hello. I really believe that the media is not giving us accurate, unbiased picture of the North Koreans' position, and I think that could lead to a war. I ask people to just look up this phrase. Trump's intel chief stated that North Korea is not offensive. It's defensive. It is not. It is rational. And Kim learned from the U.S. disarming and destruction of Iraq and Libya to get nukes and to never give up its nuclear deterrent. But that was stated at an insider's Aspen Institute. I don't think that he wanted that to get out to the American public, because they would not be demonizing North Korea successfully if they realized that the United States killed about 20 to 30% of the Korean people in the Korean War, and has been practicing for 70 years off its shores and at its borders and at its waters.
Well, John, I want to give our guests a chance to respond to that. Anita, what is the North Korea's position when it comes to denuclearization and their defensive posture, and do you think U.S. officials understand it?
Well, I mean, that has been actually the, you know, the crux of the issue here, right? President Trump has said very sort of plainly and simply, right? He says denuclearization is the key, right? He wants that. He had originally said, although now the White House is softening just a little bit, that that would have to come in all, you know, one time, you know, wouldn't be over time. It would happen at one meeting. And you talk to people that are study North Korea, that have watched the U.S.-North Korea relations for decades now, that they say that's just not going to happen. And I think people have been really saying that and pushing that out there. It's a question of, you know, whether the White House is willing to go there anyway. Are they willing to have that conversation anyway? And it sounds like they are. You saw the president soften a little bit, you know, saying that it might not happen just on June 12th. It might take longer, you know, it might take more stages. So I think they are coming to that realization. But yes, there are many, many people that follow North Korea who say they cannot be trusted, and that they aren't going to do this. And they haven't fully said that they would do this.
And Jack, it seems that the North Korean officials are looking for something maybe akin to the JCPOA that the United States entered into with Iran before President Trump pulled it out. Clearly, the U.S. officials want something stronger. But is there a plan going in on exactly how to get there?
There doesn't seem to be. And this comes as a leak report from the CIA says that the North Koreans don't intend to give up their weapons, quote, anytime soon. And then the question of giving them up. Well, there's a Stanford professor who looks at this, who's been over there, and he said, well, even if they agreed to give them up, it might take as long as 15 years to work out all the permutations of that. 15 years isn't a time horizon that the president would be comfortable with. You know, the whole thing, the president seems to be increasingly in a hurry to get at least the appearance of a deal, fanfare, a big moment. And it contradicts one of the things he said in his book, The Art of the Deal, which, of course, he didn't write. But he wrote there, the worst thing you can possibly do in a deal is to seem desperate to make it. That makes the other guy smell blood, and then you're dead. Well, do the North Koreans smell blood from a president who wants a, quote, victory looking ahead to the fall campaign?
All right, let's turn to the Russia inquiry. And this week we learned that President Trump was trying to get Attorney General Jeff Sessions to recuse himself, reportedly on multiple occasions. He reportedly tried on multiple occasions to get that done. Phil, what does this tell us, and what does that mean for the ongoing obstruction probe by Robert Mueller?
Well, it's not a totally surprising development, because we know that Trump has been agitated about Sessions' recusal ever since it happened more than a year ago. But it's yet another episode in a case file of potential obstruction of justice that Mueller and his team is building. And that's potentially quite dangerous for President Trump. I think it's important, by the way, for everyone listening to understand that Attorney General Jeff Sessions did not recuse himself out of a choice. I mean, mean, it wasn't that he simply didn't want to be involved in this investigation. It was because he had had a meeting with the Russian ambassador during the Trump campaign when he was a top surrogate and official on the Trump campaign. And he lied about that under oath to Senate during his confirmation hearing to become attorney general. Because of that conflict of interest, he therefore had to recuse himself. It was not appropriate, according to sort of protocol and practice at the Department of Justice, for him to be overseeing the probe into Russian interference, and therefore he passed the buck to his deputy, Rod Rosenstein. Mm.
President Trump's attorney and former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani told CNN's State of the Union Sunday that the attempt to discredit the Mueller investigation and the latest Spygate controversy are part of a public relations campaign to sway voter opinion and keep impeachment at bay.
We're defending here. It is for public opinion, because eventually the decision here is going to be impeach, not impeach. Members of Congress, Democrat and Republican, are going to be informed a lot by their constituents. So our jury is the, as it should be, is the American people. And the American people, yes, are Republicans, largely, okay, independents, pretty substantially, and even some Democrats now question the legitimacy of it.
Anita, is this mostly for show?
It's interesting to hear him say that, because he's out there giving 10 interviews a day. He's also trying to sway public opinion, right? I mean, he's right to a certain extent. There are people that disagree, legal experts, about, you know, could a president be charged? Can they be charged later? Can, you know, after they're out of office? What the reality is, that's probably not going to happen. So then it does go to Congress. Will Congress impeach or not impeach? And they have a decision to make depending on what happens. So, I mean, in a certain extent, he's right about that. And he must be thinking that, because he's trying to sway public opinion. He's out there talking about this every day. I mean, that's something that we hadn't seen previously, right, with the president's attorney, that he was out there this much talking. Now, the one thing I would say about Rudy Giuliani is he often contradicts himself. So he'll say one thing and the next day he'll say something else. So it's actually muddied the waters quite a bit.
Jack, this week, Republican Congressman Trey Gowdy was the latest to say that this is not a Spygate mm-hmm. situation. Of course, Congressman Gowdy is not running for reelection. Might we see more Republicans throwing cold water on this?
Well, it would be encouraging if they did. It probably would also be miraculous. You know, Mr. Giuliani talks about influencing the jury of the people. One way they're doing that is attacking rationality. The president's lies this week about this really reached toxic level. He retweeted a Rush Limbaugh tweet in which Limbaugh said the FBI should have told him they were investigating his campaign. The FBI did tell him. Mm-hmm. And then he tweeted again, I may have said, I never fired James Comey because of Russia. Wait a minute. We saw on television in his interview with Lester Holt, he said, this Russia thing and Trump, you know, I was thinking about that when I fired Comey. We saw that. This comes in the week of when the Washington Post reported that he's up to now 3,251, counting, false or misleading claims in the 500 days he's been president. It just seems to go on and on. But this week, denying things that he said, denying things that are on the record, he seems to have reached a point where he feels he can say anything, and the cult-like core of his followers will swallow it.
All right. In other news, ABC canceled Roseanne after the star tweeted a racist tweet about Valerie Jarrett. And President Trump questioned why ABC hasn't apologized for the things that they've said about him. Meanwhile, Samantha Bee was called out by the White House for a comment she made about Ivanka Trump, which was profane. The White House called it vile and vicious. What are we learning from this, Phil? What does this tell us about the current discourse in America?
Well, the discourse is not good. Both what Roseanne said and what Samantha Bee said is really inappropriate, and it's sad that that people in public life are using language like that. It's been interesting to see how President Trump has responded to it, by the way. He's sort of portrayed himself as a victim as well, saying, you know, where's the apology from ABC bosses for the crude and bad things that people on that network have said about him over the years? He's very much trying to identify with Roseanne's supporters, with people who would share a sense of grievance that they've been persecuted unfairly by the media establishment, by other, you know, powerful interests around the country, and seems to be trying to do that to, you know, some political effect, or at least with the people who support him in the country. But in terms of the overall discourse in this country, it's very sad.
Let's get to another caller. David is calling from Oklahoma City. Thanks for calling, David.
Hi, Kim. I can see no parallels between Roseanne and Samantha. And basically, Roseanne has a long history of racism, as does Trump. And Samantha, while the language, I'm sure, was offensive to some, you know, Giuliani's out there saying, oh, Trump's beautiful daughter Ivanka has to be exempt. No, she doesn't. She is a top advisor. She willfully took that position. And she all spewed all this rhetoric about mothers and children, and she was going to be the champion, and she's done nothing. So, no, she's an advisor now, just the same way that when John Kelly took off his uniform, he's no longer a military hero. He is a part of an administration that he himself has proven racial bias. So there are no parallels here whatsoever.
David, thanks for that call. Anita, what do you think about that?
I think it's a really interesting point, and it's actually something I've heard from a lot of, you know, that a little bit of anger there that I've heard from a lot of people who thought that Ivanka Trump, his daughter, they're obviously very close, now a top aide, would change him, would change President Trump in office. And, you know, they thought she would do so many things, right? They thought she would do all these policy initiatives she talked about, but they also thought she would soften him a bit and get him to change his mind on things from climate change and all sorts of other things. And there's a sort of a resentment that I've been hearing from a lot of people. And these are more moderate Republicans, Democrats even, who had sort of counted on her to change him in office. And anger that she hasn't, that she's not more influential.
Robin is calling from Memphis, Tennessee. Hi, Robin.
Hi, Kim. I wanted to make a statement about the Roseanne Barr and Samantha. What Roseanne Barr said was ridiculous. She should have been fired. I'm a woman of color, but I've always liked Roseanne. I didn't know she was like that. Samantha should be fired also. What she said about that man's daughter, I don't care if he is president. I'm not a Trump fan. But it was disgusting. She should not be allowed to talk like that on TV to anyone.
All right, Robin, thank you for that call. Kim is calling from Oklahoma City. What's your thought, Kim?
Hi, Kim. My thought is that we're comparing apples and oranges. Roseanne made a horribly racist comment. Samantha was vulgar and offensive, but it's not the same thing.
Hmm. So, Jack, what do you think about that? Is there a difference between those two comments?
I think there is, which doesn't at all exculpate Samantha for the crudity and misogyny of her comment. But to me, the best comment on all of this was by Matthew Miller, a former Justice Department official in the Obama administration, so no fan of President Trump. Nevertheless, he said it this way about the Roseanne matter. You just can't expect to say blatantly racist stuff and expect to keep your job unless you're president of the United States.
Yeah. So also this week, Starbucks closed its stores for implicit bias training. Phil, in just a few seconds before we break, is there a place for corporations to step in and sort of deal with these racial issues or these issues of tension and culture where the government isn't doing it?
There certainly is a place for that, and I understand why Starbucks would want to do this training, given the history of what's happened in some of their coffee stores. But there's really no substitute for presidential leadership on an issue like this. And, when there are these divisions in the country, it's the time when the elected president ordinarily would try to come forward and offer some leadership and words of guidance and counsel for the citizens, and we haven't seen that yet.
All right. We're discussing the week in the news. I'm Kimberly Atkins. This is On Point.
Planet Money tip number 17. A great analogy doesn't have to make sense.
Busier than a one-legged bobcat covering up his own crap on a frozen pond.
Didn't you just make that up?
Well, yeah. I
just... Planet Money, a poetic podcast about the economy.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins. In other news this week, Russian journalist Arkady Babchenko, who was believed murdered, turned up alive. Gasps rang out from the crowd at a press conference in Ukraine Wednesday. 14-year-old Karthik Namani of Texas became the champion Scripps National Spelling Bee last night after spelling a word which means Christian fellowship or communion.
Koinonia. K-O-I-N-O-N-I-A. Koinonia.
That is correct.
And the song cover you thought you never needed to hear. 90s pop punk band Weezer released their cover of Toto's Africa on Tuesday.
I hear the drums echoing tonight, but she hears only whispers of some quiet conversation.
You can join the conversation. What's your top story of the week? After meeting with Santa Fe, Texas families yesterday, will President Trump take firm steps for school safety? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guests this hour are Anita Kumar of McClatchy, Philip Rucker of The Washington Post, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Now let's turn to immigration, Anita. This week, President Trump held a rally in Nashville, which focused very strongly on immigration. Meanwhile, the White House's, the Trump administration's zero policy deterrence at borders means that everyone gets detained, and that means that people with young children get separated from them. How has the immigration debate changed this week moving forward, Anita?
Well, if you ever have heard a Trump rally since he's been president, or listened in or heard anything about them, he often goes back to immigration at those rallies. It's, you know, these are Trump supporters. This is his base. They very much want to hear about immigration. He gets a great response when he talks about it, because this is one of the biggest things he talked about during his campaign. He's been frustrated, though, that he hasn't been able to, you know, I know a lot of people are criticizing him for his policies, and he's frustrated that he hasn't been able to move quicker, partly because of, you know, court cases and things tied up, you know, on the travel ban and sanctuary cities and other things he's talked about. So, you know, they are talking a lot about this report that was in the New York Times a few days ago about, quote, missing children. And the White House is pushing back hard on this issue, saying they're not missing. We just haven't connected that, you know, people didn't answer calls and we haven't connected with them. But they really are pushing back on calling them missing children.
Then these are children under HHS care after they've been placed with some sort of guardian after they're released from detention. Right.
Right. And I think this really, I mean, like so many things, this sort of took off online, you know, on Twitter, there's different hashtags for find the children or where are the children. And they really, I think it took a couple days for them to really realize that they needed to push back. So when we came back, you know, there's a long weekend and then they came back and they have decided this week that they really needed to push back. And it took a couple days for them to kind of push back on that and say what they wanted to say.
So at that campaign rally in Nashville, which was for Republican Marsha Blackburn, who's running for Senate there in Tennessee, President Trump repeated his claim that Mexico will fund a border wall.
In the end, Mexico's going to pay for the wall. I'm just telling you. All right? I don't want to cause any problem. But in the end, Mexico's paying for the wall.
Of course, the president of Mexico has repeatedly said that's not going to happen. Jack, are we going to keep hearing about the wall moving forward to the midterms and beyond?
I think so. I mean, the president said in Nashville that a hard line on immigration was a winning line for the Republicans. And although there are marginal Republican districts where that isn't true, and the Times today has a story about them, on the whole, it's a base issue. It brings out the, you know, the president's galvanic announcement that they're sending rapists, they're sending murderers, et cetera, the xenophobia that's at the bottom of the Trump appeal is right there, and he's going right back to it with this tough and cruel. And Nicholas Kristof goes further and calls it evil immigration policy, evil because people applying for asylum here, who are, that is to say, they're not trying to sneak into the country. They're presenting themselves and they're saying, we have a well-founded fear of persecution. Can you investigate and allow us in? They're being separated from their small children. That is cruel.
And a caller is waiting, Martha, who is calling from Jefferson, Maine. Thanks for your patience, Martha.
Hi. I'm calling because I was going to make exactly that same comment about Nicholas Kristof's column and the fact that it's not people who are running across the border who are being separated from their children. And he gave an example of a mother who was separated from her blind child and said, yes, this is evil. And yet Trump goes to rallies, and what does he yell about the wall? We're talking about people here, human beings, and we are a country of immigrants who should be embracing immigrants. And I think that we need immigrants because we're going to have a Social Security problem in the future because we're going to have too many baby boomers who are retiring. And plus, we need, you know, with the tax cuts, we need a broader tax base. So, you know, we should be welcoming immigrants.
And this seems to be, and Martha, thank you for that call. This seems to be an issue that is really front and center as the midterms approach, Phil. On the one hand, I have Democrats telling me all the time that they need to emphasize that we need immigrants for our economy. Even the president utilizes immigrant labor at Mar-a-Lago. On the other hand, I have GOP strategists saying all the time that the strong get tough message on immigration is going to help Republicans hold on to the Senate and maybe even stave off a turnover at the House. What do you think, Phil?
Well, immigration is a very difficult issue for the Republican Party because on the one hand, a hardline immigration stance like the one President Trump has been espousing is important to motivating and galvanizing the most sort of loyal conservative Republican voters. But a lot of swing voters, a lot of kind of soft Republicans, the kind of Republicans who supported George Bush and Mitt Romney but were not so keen to have Donald Trump as the nominee, are looking for a more compassionate approach and are much more open to the DREAM Act, for example, or ways to help immigrants integrate into American life. And I think it's also worth keeping in mind that a number of the most competitive House districts, races, are going to be in suburban America, in the kind of suburbs where a lot of moderate, even if right-leaning voters live. And a lot of the key Senate races are going to be in border states that have been dealing with immigration for years, places like Arizona, Florida, and Nevada.
Nora is calling from New Hartford, Connecticut. Nora, thanks for the call.
Hi, I was just hoping to make a comment. Thanks for taking my call, Kim. I was hoping to just get some feedback on the connection to, you know, between immigration and this, you know, precedented, you know, precedent between immigration and also the fugitive slave law, you know, considering America's horrible history of slavery, this belief that human beings can be labeled criminals for trying to seek the means to live securely and even trying to just survive. Also, you know, the deputizing of federal and local law enforcement to enforce really unjust policies, the systematic dehumanization of immigrants for the purpose of oppression. There's certainly a precedent for this in our history. And also the weaponization of separating families as well. This was rampant during the era of slavery in the United States. And I was just hoping to hear some feedback between, you know, between the, you know, from your commentators and what this means for the moral legacy of the administration. Thank you.
Yeah, Jack, you know, we did hear the president referring to some immigrants. He said he was referring to gang members, but it's referring to them as animals and really getting tough. Is this reminiscent of terrible times in our history?
Well, I thought the Nora's comparison to the Fugitive Slave Act is, as I'm thinking about it, is disturbingly apt, because that was a case of the whole power of the federal government coming down on people who were escaping from what couldn't be a more well-founded fear of persecution, namely slavery. And in northern city after northern city, slave catchers, you know, hunted down people who had escaped and returned them to bondage. And, you know, families were separated, certainly, but and great cruelty was done. But that at least, you could say at least, in the context of the time, that was a way to keep the Union together. That was the price of admitting California to the Union as the 31st star, the state that would break the balance between free and the 15-15 balance between free and slave. At least it had that pragmatic purpose. What purpose does this have?
Let's turn to the issue of school shootings. Of course, Trump met yesterday with Santa Fe families while on a fundraising trip in Texas. And also, White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders audibly choked up during Wednesday's press briefing as she answered a student's question about school shootings. 13-year-old Benji Shikroon was at the White House covering a children's fitness event. He was called on as he sat among the White House press corps.
Can you tell me what the administration has done and will do to prevent these senseless tragedies?
I think that as a kid and certainly as a parent, there is nothing that could be more terrifying for a kid to go to school and not feel safe. So I'm sorry that you feel that way. This administration takes it seriously. And the School Safety Commission that the president convened is meeting this week, again, an official meeting, to discuss the best ways forward and how we can do every single thing within our power to protect kids in our schools.
Anita, Sarah Huckabee Sanders got choked up there, but is the policy coming out of the White House matching that emotion?
Right. She did get choked up. It's, you know, she's a mother of preschoolers, obviously, that she's probably thinking about them going to school one day. You know, the rhetoric from the White House has been pretty similar to what it's been the last few weeks. You know, after Parkland, the shooting in Parkland in Florida, we had seen the president sort of suggest out loud, talking out loud, you know, raising the age limits or the age for buying certain kinds of guns and doing other things that the NRA and people that other people, you know, oppose. We haven't heard that. We haven't heard that in weeks. We haven't heard that in quite some time. Mm. You mentioned his meeting yesterday. That meeting obviously was closed. But some of the parents who met with President Trump talked to local reporters afterwards, and they didn't say that he said anything different. You know, he has talked about arming teachers. I think he specifically talked about having armed security at schools. He's talked about making the building safer. He has not, in recent weeks at all, talked anything about really substantive changes. Now, he does have his education secretary, Betsy DeVos, is leading a group that's supposed to look into anything that they might do, policies. But he hasn't proposed anything significant, and he also hasn't pushed the Congress to do anything significant. And the White House says that they're going to wait until Betsy DeVos finishes this up and gives some suggestions.
Phil, do you think that school safety, these school shootings, will be an issue that resonates in the midterms?
Potentially. You know, this issue in the past has not shown to be a decisive issue in elections. It certainly is a motivating factor for small slices of the electorate on both ends, both, you know, gun safety proponents and gun owners who are NRA members and so forth. But I think this year could be different. What we saw after Parkland was young people mobilizing in a really unprecedented way, trying to create a movement, stirring passions. around the country. We'll see if that can have a political effect, if it means that more young people are motivated to come out and vote than they ordinarily would in the midterm elections. That could make a difference. But it's a little bit too early to determine.
All right. Lindsay is calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Lindsay.
Hi, Kim. I'd just like to say that I think we're really doing this conversation a disservice by talking about school safety. This conversation exists not just at the peripheries where these things are happening. Yes, they're happening at schools, but they're also happening at concerts. They're happening at movie theaters. They're happening at shopping malls. I'm the mother of three, and I'd like to really talk about how to keep my kids safe everywhere that they go. And the only way to do that is to address guns in this country.
Thank you for that call, Lindsay. Jack, what do you think about that?
Well, I think that's an anxiety that every parent must feel. And what do you tell your children about such things? You know, in all of this debate, I don't think enough attention has been paid to something the Boston Globe did in March. They pointed out that if the rest of the country adopted the gun control policies of the state of Massachusetts, which don't seem to me to be onerous, potentially 27,000 lives could be saved. That is to say, if the proportion were the same of gun deaths in Massachusetts were the same as in the country, it would be 27,000 people a year fewer would be murdered. Mm. That's just amazing to me. And when you looked at what the Massachusetts laws were, they weren't terrible things. They were just, you know, you had to know, the sheriff, the local police had to know about the changes in gun registry. The point is, it was not onerous.
Right.
And people in Massachusetts have guns. And there's a model right there.
All right. That's On Point's own Jack Beatty. Have a good weekend, Jack.
Thank you.
Anita Kumar, White House correspondent for McClatchy, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
Philip Rucker, White House bureau chief for the Washington Post. Great to have you with us, Phil.
Have a great day. Thank you.
And you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Anna Bowman, Brian Hardzinski, Eileen Amata, Stefano Kotsonis, Allison Poli, Catherine Proctor, Tanya Rally, Jeremy Relosa, and James Ross. The executive producer is Karen Schiffman. Coming up Monday, primaries to watch, Congress back to work, Summit Reality Check. Top reporters open their notebooks and share with us what to watch for next week. I'm Kimberly Atkins, and this is On Point.